Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. For almost a century, America has been the leading research country in the world, creating technology that has altered the way we live countless times. To help support the drive for innovation, the government has supplemented and supported research institutions and universities to back up researchers. However, with the government shutdown hitting its 35th day, researchers are starting to worry as their funds are not able to be dispersed. And with no one to contact, what are researchers supposed to do? Joining us now, we have Ian Morgan, a furloughed scientist with the National Institutes of Health and the steward for the NIH Fellows Union, which represents 5,000 researchers across various NIH campuses. Welcome to All Sides, Ian.
Hi, thanks for having me, Amy.
And also with us, we have Professor Chris Orban, a computational physicist and education researcher at Ohio State University, serving the Marion and Columbus campuses. He's a part of a group called Stand Up for Science at Ohio State University, which is raising awareness about the disruption and defunding of American science. Welcome back to All Sides, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
Ian, let's start with you. Very broadly, how is the government shutdown impacting research? Are they pausing contracts, not following through on payments? Can researchers, you know, reach the government with questions?
Sure. Well, I'll just give an example myself. I am a scientist who works at the NIH, and I haven't been able to actually go into work to do any of my research for over a month.
You're not allowed in the building. Yeah.
Is not even allowed in the building, not allowed to do anything. I mean, and my work focuses on antibacterial resistance, which is, you know, one of the leading global public health threats. And I haven't been able to work on that for a month. So that's, I mean, that's just step one. But then, as you mentioned in the lead, right, we're not allowed to have disbursements of payments, right, to researchers across the country. And, you know, researchers in Ohio, right? Oh, I looked it up about $1 billion a year in just Ohio alone, which goes to support jobs for researchers, universities, hospitals, and biotech startups. And those people rely on that. And when there's uncertainties in funding, you know, you have to start tightening your belt or maybe not doing that next breakthrough treatment that people are relying on.
And Chris, researchers at places like Ohio State, they're not federal employees, but they're still being impacted by the government shutdown. How so?
Yeah, so we are state of Ohio employees, and we work with the federal government, and the federal government funds the research. So, for example, I am the principal investigator on about $500,000 National Science Foundation grant, and that grant hasn't been directly affected, but I can't talk to the staff member at the National Science Foundation about different issues I might have in spending those funds.
Mm. And can you tell me specifically what that grant is for? Like, what are you researching with the $500,000?
Yeah, so that's a grant, and it's actually in partnership with Wright-Patterson Air Force Base to do research with lasers, to try to use lasers to accelerate protons and ions to as high of an energy as we can do it. Mm.
And Ian, you mentioned that you're not able to get into your lab. You can't do your research. You're not the only one, right? So it's there's a whole lot of research that was active and happening, and it's all paused. What are you hearing from friends?
Yeah. So I mean, again, I represent as part of the union over 5,000 early career researchers, and we've been calling them during this shutdown, and a lot of them are saying, oh, you know, maybe at the first they had a few days off, right? But then it quickly became, you know, they can't do the type of research that people are relying on. They can't make the next breakthroughs, right? And, you know, specifically for early career researchers like me, I mean, this is a really short time limited appointment that we have in these positions. So it's affecting the entire future of our careers. So it's not just the fact that it's a short pause, but it means it could have really big lasting impacts for us as scientists, and it could have lasting impacts for the work that we're trying to do, like treatments to cure cancer, right?
Yeah, so when you're saying it's a you have a short window, does that mean you have like a 1 year or 2 year appointment to do something and now you're missing a whole month of that?
Yeah, exactly. So I'm about 3 years into my postdoc, right? And usually it lasts about 4 years and renewed every year. And I was calculating it recently and I realized I've already have a significant chunk, like something like 2% of my postdoc is just gone out the window where I haven't been able to do work. And that's going to affect my ability to get a job. And that's affecting the ability of a lot of other people to get a job in the future. So, and it has a huge impact on the future of the United States as a leader in biomedical research.
And Chris, you've been on the show before talking about reduction in research funding from the Trump administration. So if you combined that reduction in funding with this government shutdown, do you feel like it's a double whammy?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I came on the show, I think it was July, we talked about how there was $15 million of grants that were already awarded and like being worked on that just were clawed back by the federal government. That's $15 million is the number that we talked about. Ohio State University on through the year, and I can't give you official numbers. I'm sure that the OSU official is watching this. They can respond. But in any given last year, Ohio State got $770 million from the federal government to do research. And so if you divide that by 12, that's over $60 million that is just going to be missing, I suppose.
And the idea of the government shutdown lingering on past, you know, we're heading into month two. How do you feel as a researcher who wants to be doing things but can't move forward in certain ways when you don't know when the end will be? How does that make you feel?
I mean, professors are just constantly thinking about grants. Like, I don't know how to explain it to you.
Yeah.
Like, we read a research paper and we think about, oh, I could write a grant about that. Like, it's because we have to support our graduate students, we have to support our undergrads, we have to support our postdocs. And so, the federal grants are the lifeblood of our university. That $770 million, I mean, undergraduate and graduate tuition is like $1 billion. So it's like it's almost as much money that we get from the federal government to do research as we get from tuition from students. And that's how important this is to the university.
And Ian, when it comes to the Trump administration doing a reduction in research funding overall, did you feel like So I'm guessing your research was continuing and it was still funded. So you were like, yay, I have funding. I can continue to do my my research. And now the government shutdown has happened. So now you're like, oh, wait, now I can't. Is it do you feel like a back and forth there?
Yeah, I'd actually like to respond both to the question that you posed before to Chris and this question, because it has felt like a lot more of the same that we've been facing over the past 9 months. So we were banned from actually talking to outside researchers for a while. We weren't allowed to spend any money to get resources to be able to do life-saving biomedical research at the NIH. We then lost a bunch of people who were essential to the work that we were doing. And so as soon as we were allowed to start ordering supplies to do our work, we lost the people who actually helped us order those supplies. So we're no longer to get those supplies. So it's actually just felt like one hit after another, one roadblock after another that's coming up. So it really feels like this shutdown is actually a symptom of a much, much larger problem. And so things weren't just going along smoothly and then this shutdown happened. I mean, one of the things I think that has been brought up as an issue in this shutdown is just to be able to protect the you know, both federal workers and the services that they provide to the American people and things like the research money that's going out. So yes, maybe the answer to your question is it's a lot more of the same and it's affecting everybody and we need some protections from this. It's just not acceptable if we want the United States to be a leader in science.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about research funding with Ian Morgan, a furloughed scientist at the National Institutes of Health, and Professor Chris Orban, a computational physicist and education researcher at Ohio State University. Chris, what do you want people to know about this research funding and how the government shutdown is impacting research? Because the government shutdown is impacting a lot of things. You know, we're hearing about SNAP benefits and people not being able to have enough food. We are hearing about the, you know, air traffic controllers and worries about planes. So how do you make people realize that caring about, you know, the research money is important too?
Yeah, I mean, scientists are not interested in debating who's suffering the most from the shutdown. So mm-hmm. that's not what I'm here to do. But I need people to understand that it's no longer the quote-unquote woke projects that are being affected. It's every single department at Ohio State University and quite a lot of what's going on at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and NASA Glenn that are all affected by this. NASA Glenn has something like 1,300 employees. Mm-hmm. I'm told that only 78 are currently working. Mm-hmm. That's 95% of NASA Glenn that's sitting at home is what I'm told. Wright-Patterson Air Force Base on a given day is estimated 38,000 people coming in. That's civilian employees, contractors, active duty. I'm told that something like 10,000 Air Force civilian employees have been furloughed. Mm. And then, you know, in the lab that I collaborate with Wright-Pat, there's three civilian employees that are there. Those are all furloughed. But those of us that are contractors, you know, there's three or four contractors, and so the lab is shut down. So just because it's only three employees that are shut down, the whole lab is just sitting there doing nothing while China and Russia does all this research.
Hmm. Ian, earlier this year we did a show about America's brain drain and how talented researchers are leaving the U.S. for other countries. Do you think all this uncertainty caused by the shutdown will motivate researchers to actually pursue things elsewhere?
Yes, absolutely. Mm. I mean, we saw a poll of researchers earlier in the year that said about 75%, so 3 in 4 researchers who were considering leaving the United States to go somewhere else. I don't have a more recent poll, but I know anecdotally just from talking to other postdocs like myself that the only way that they can actually pursue a career is by leaving the United States. There is absolutely a brain drain that is being forced by all of these cuts to research, by all of the uncertainty, by all of these things like the government shutdown, right? And unless science and innovation thrives on having stability, and right now we're not seeing that.
And Chris, do you feel supported enough to stick around? Would you ever consider, you know, taking your research elsewhere? You a Buckeye?
I was conceived in Dayton, Ohio, so by my dad dotted the I in Script, Ohio, so I'm very reluctant to leave. But I will say that if someone was recruiting me from somewhere else, I'd take it. I'd seriously consider it. Mm.
So you said that someone like you is thinking about grants all the time, but now you're not just thinking about grants all the time. You're thinking about missing grants or what happens if you don't find a grant. And just talk to me about how the federal government shutdown and also just lack of support of research is impacting what you do.
Yeah, so let me give an example. So I have a friend of mine who applied for an NIH grant, and the NIH, when you apply for any grant, there's a panel review, a scientific panel review, where experts across the country weigh in on what they think the most exciting and interesting and impactful research will be. And their grant was supposed to go through the scientific review during the month of October, but now that has been canceled. So even if the funding is there, the review of that grant might be 6 months in the future. Mm. And so think about, so the NIH, Ohio State got some, of the $1 billion coming to Ohio, Ohio State got something like $700 million of NIH funds. If even one of those scientific panel reviews is delayed, that's money that's greatly delayed from Ohio State, which affects students, postdocs, faculty, et cetera.
And Ian, I mean, you're there working for the National Institute of Health. And I mentioned to Chris earlier, you know, people are talking about the government shutdown and, you know, they're worried about SNAP benefits. They're worried about air traffic controllers and that kind of thing. But what would you say about, you know, not just your research, but research being delayed? Because I think right now a lot of people would say, oh, 30 days is not that much. Even though we can't find an end to it, what would you say to them about the need to get the government open, but then also support this?
Yeah, so I turned them to a story that came out from actually a patient who came to the NIH about earlier this year in June. This patient's name was Richard, a metastatic cancer patient who faced critical delays in his treatment. He was supposed to get that treatment in 4 to 6 weeks, but because of the ongoing turmoil at the NIH, which is now being exacerbated, we see here. It actually prevented his treatment, even though the treatment was already being stored and ready in a freezer. And this is a cancer patient whose life is on the line. And if they don't get their treatment in time, they may die, or they may get another treatment that doesn't work so well. And this is the cost that people are facing across the country if there are delays in treatments and delays in funding that is going out at these hospitals which receive NIH funding, even at the NIH itself, if there are these delays and have workforce not being able to work properly. Right now, the NIH can't accept any new patients for treatments like this. So this is not a theoretical thing or something that's going to have problems in the future. It is actually patients' lives who are on the line right now because of a turmoil that we faced over the last several months and that we're currently facing during this shutdown. So, and that's why we need it to end. We need people to go back and to actually be there at the negotiating table to stop this from happening, to make sure that we don't have these ongoing delays.
Chris, what would you say to people who are listening right now? They call their congressman and ask them to open the government.
Yeah, I mean, what I want to see when I get home from teaching at the end of the day is I want to see pictures of flustered politicians in Washington annoyed at the deal that was struck. You know, I don't want the images of this to be Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez broadcasting from her closet in New York. I don't want the images to be Mike Johnson standing alongside Republicans and no one else doing these press conferences. I want to see people going into a room and coming out of a room and trying to work this thing out because that's what the country needs.
I want to thank you so much for your time. We've been talking with Professor Chris Orban, a computational physicist and education researcher at Ohio State University. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And also thank you to Ian Morgan, a furloughed scientist at the National Institutes of Health. Ian, thanks for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
And coming up, we're going to talk about voting machines. It is Election Day. That's when Tech Tuesday continues from all sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. After 5 years of debate in a post-2020 election cycle, Dominion Voting Systems, the company responsible for providing voting machines, has been sold and rebranded as Liberty Vote. The new owner, a former Republican director for the St. Louis City Board of Elections, is rehauling and changing what role Dominion will have in future elections. So what does this mean for voting in the future, and how will it affect the way we vote? Joining us now is David Becker, executive director and founder of the Center for Election Innovation. Welcome to the show, David.
Thanks for having me on, Amy.
So recently, Dominion Voting Systems, the company that provided voting systems for U.S. elections, was bought by this Republican director from St. Louis. How do you think that this change will impact future elections?
I actually think this won't impact future elections much at all. Dominion is one of three major vendors of what we call vote tabulation equipment, the machines that take the paper ballots in and count them really fast and really accurately. We need those machines because we have very complicated ballots in Ohio and all over the nation with lots of different contests on them. Dominion is, I believe, the second largest of the vendors. So there's lots of different vendors, three of them major vendors. And this new company has basically bought their equipment and is going to continue to sell it and service it. I think from the voters' perspective, they're going to see no change whatsoever, regardless of whether their counties utilize formerly Dominion systems or a different vendor's systems. They're going to see the same auditable, verifiable, recountable paper ballots that they're used to seeing.
So is it just a name change, Dominion to Liberty, and it'll change to stay the same?
Well, it's a name and a management change for sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is new management. But again, every system in the United States is certified. It has to abide by whatever the state law has. And importantly, we don't just trust those machines. The paper ballots are really at the core of why we can trust our elections in the United States. 98% of all voters vote on paper ballots nationwide. The only state that doesn't is Louisiana. There's a few counties in Texas that also are moving a little more slowly towards paper ballots. But in Ohio and nationwide, almost every voter votes on an auditable, recountable, verifiable paper ballot. And that means that we use the machines to get quick and accurate counts. But still in Ohio and across the entire nation, election officials then verify those counts through audits and other means. So it really, I don't think this really makes a huge difference, certainly from the perspective of the voter and certainly from the perspective of election integrity.
So this idea of prioritizing paper voting, I think it's confusing to people because when they go up and walk up to a machine and vote, it's electronic. They're touching a screen, but you're talking about the paper that's inside.
So there's two major ways that people tend to vote on paper ballots in the United States. One is what we call a hand-marked ballot. All mail ballots are hand-marked because mm-hmm. you're at home without the machine there. And usually fill in a bubble or connect an arrow, and that ballot then gets fed into a tabulator where software tabulates each of the ballots, each of the races on the ballots, and keeps a count going. The other way that many people vote in the United States is what we call machine marked ballots. And you're right, there's a touch screen that looks a lot like an iPad or some other kind of screen that you might see. And that touch screen will move you through the voting process. Those touch screens can allow for things like minority languages or larger type, which can be very handy. But all that touch screen is doing and that computer is doing is instructing a printer to print a paper ballot. That printed paper ballot that you then take from that device, it's called a ballot marking device, then goes into a separate tabulator. And you have to look at that paper ballot again to make sure that it reflects your correct choices, just like you'd have to look at a hand-marked ballot to make sure that you haven't made any mistakes when filling it out. But both are verifiable, both are auditable, both are entirely secure.
So when politicians talk about wanting to prioritize paper voting, are they thinking about these machines, though, or are they literally thinking that they want paper in people's hands when you vote?
I have no idea what they're thinking. What I can tell you is 98% of people vote on paper ballots. They're auditable and verifiable. It doesn't matter whether you fill it out by hand or whether you mark it on a touchscreen device. You're still getting a ballot that is then independently verified and counted and audited. And so both systems work very well. Some have their advantages to some and not to the other. For instance, hand-marked paper ballots are very handy for things like mail voting. Mm-hmm. But machine-marked ballots, ballot marking devices for those voters that have them, are very handy for early voting, very handy for voters who might have some kind of special needs or minority language assistance.
Will we ever move to not paper ballots, a more technology-influenced way of voting? You know, it makes me think of how many millions of people vote every week for Dancing with the Stars. You know, will we ever do it differently?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's one I get quite a bit. There's a big difference between Dancing for the Stars. If we get it wrong, the nation is not going to go off the rails, obviously.
I don't know about that. There's very opinionated people.
It'll be a problem for some, but not quite as bad as getting
president.
No,
I'm joking.
Wrong.
Yeah.
Even more importantly, the reason that we're not going to see digital voting, purely digital voting without paper anytime soon is because we have a secret ballot in the United States. And with a secret ballot in the United States, you need to be able to have an artifact of the vote, i.e. the paper, long after the voter has left, that we can't necessarily go back and say, hey, did you vote this way? But we can be sure that that person saw the same piece of paper. It's really hard to do that digitally, and it's impossible to do that digitally in a way that will satisfy supporters of the losing candidate. You really need to have the paper ballots there to confirm that the ballots that were verified and voted by the voters are then going to be reviewed in a close election or a recount. It's often said in elections, the purpose of elections is to convince the losers that they lost. And that's what we do very well in the United States. And it's thanks to paper ballots. It's really an old school approach, but it works very, very well, particularly when we have such complicated and sometimes close elections in the United States.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about voting machines with David Becker, executive director and founder of the Center for Election Innovation. So it's there's been a lot of talk of voter fraud. It happens all the time over the years. There were a lot of talk of voter fraud with Dominion and with the Biden administration. But now that Dominion's been sold and has a new name and Biden is out of office, where's the new target of voter fraud? What are we talking about next?
Well, what we've seen is, you're right, there has been a lot of talk about voter fraud, much more talk of voter fraud than actual voter fraud that exists. I served as a lawyer in the Department of Justice under both the Clinton and W. Bush administrations doing voting work. I can tell you election fraud is one of the easiest crimes to catch. If you commit it, you will get caught. There are people in Ohio that have been caught for doing things like double voting in other states. And you will be prosecuted. It's a very, very foolish crime to commit because it's so easy to catch. And that means we also have a really great handle on how much of it there is. In a major national election, say a presidential election, the total number of fraudulent ballots cast are probably going to be around the dozens out of about 160 million ballots cast. But what we've seen, especially in the last decade or so, is losing candidates trying to make just completely fabricated claims, conspiracy theories around why they might have lost, other than the fact that the voters just didn't prefer them. And in close elections, they've gained a certain level of support. But time and time again, our transparent, verifiable system has withstood all the scrutiny. The 2020 election in the United States is likely the most scrutinized election in American history. And it had the highest turnout in American history. And what we found time and time again is that the men and women, the public servants throughout Ohio and throughout the entire United States who run our elections did a remarkable job. And by the way, that was in the middle of a global pandemic when they themselves and their staffs were getting sick. And that's why we've seen court after court after court uphold what election officials have certified as the official results when there have been defamation lawsuits filed against Fox News for lying about the election. They settled it for nearly $800 million rather than try to put on evidence that they told the truth. Rudy Giuliani and Carrie Lake both conceded liability rather than put on evidence that would demonstrate fraud. Mike Lindell essentially did the same and was found liable for defamation. Every single time when there's been an opportunity to present actual proof of election fraud to a court, those who've made those claims on social media and raised money off those claims have run away. So that's why voters should feel very confident in our system. We're going to keep seeing this from losing candidates. I expect we're going to see some. We're already seeing some today as elections are being held in many places around the country, including some places in Ohio. Voters should just discount that. That is basically sore loserism from people who have gotten to the point where they haven't been able to persuade the voters that they should win.
In Ohio, there's been a reported, I think it's about 1,000, I think 1,080-something cases of voter fraud. I know you don't know specifically, I'm sure, every state in the nation, but do you think that some of these cases of voter fraud are about faulty voting technology ever?
So actually, I think that number is a vast overstatement. I think there have been even less than that alleged cases and fewer that have been filed. There's, for instance, been wild claims about thousands of alleged non-citizens on the lists. Yet when the Ohio Attorney General actually investigated them, they only brought five indictments throughout the entire state. And that was for a period of time of about a decade, five total indictments. So we just don't see much of these actual claims panning out. And yes, sometimes what we're seeing is that these are administrative errors. There are times when people have been accidentally registered when they shouldn't have been through no fault of their own because the state systems let them down. There have been times when there's been an allegation of someone having double voted or impersonated another vote. When you actually look at the process, it was a mistake, a normal mistake made in the process, and the person didn't actually double vote or had not impersonated another voter. What used to happen on the old, the way voters used to check in is they would, in many places, they used to sign on an actual paper poll book. next to their name. More and more we're moving to electronic poll books, but in some cases those paper poll books still exist. And one of the things we'd often find is that people would sign on the wrong line. And so just normal explainable errors. I guarantee you that the amount of voter fraud under the election officials at the state level and at the local level throughout Ohio and throughout the entire nation is incredibly low. We can't point to a single race that was affected by voter fraud. Well, there's a rare case. There's a rare case in North Carolina, and there's a rare case in Connecticut that I should mention. But both were caught immediately. And the person who was who had committed the fraud did not take office and was investigated and prosecuted. And that's the way it should be. It's impossible to steal a national election through fraud. There's just too many moving parts and too many protections.
Yeah, and just to clarify the number I said, Secretary of State Frank LaRose of Ohio said there were 1,084 alleged cases of non-citizen voting going back to 2018. So
I think that's registration, actually, Amy.
Registration errors?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just
Okay.
and those are cases that he presented to the Ohio Attorney General over a year ago. For
Oh, I see what
investigation
you mean. And
under
only five
Ohio
have been
law.
investigated. I got
The
it.
Ohio Attorney General did a remarkably thorough job of investigating those cases. And of course, his office is going to have to oversee prosecutions, and they're going to want to make sure they win. So they looked at all of these cases, and they ultimately brought five indictments. There was a sixth they might have brought, but the person had died. So out of those allegedly over 1,000 cases, the Ohio Attorney General found six that were worthy of prosecution.
Yeah, and I feel like there's one case at least where a woman was just getting her license and the person at the BMV told her to register to vote, and so she said okay, even though she wasn't supposed to. Like, is that what you mean? Like, there's a human error. That's an administrative error where the state official is telling her it's okay and she shouldn't have, or something like that.
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean. There's times when the wrong key gets hit on a keyboard. There's times when a third party registration group might have someone fill in the wrong box on a paper form, or that paper form just gets data entered wrong. There's all kinds of reasons this might happen. And also what we also find of the alleged non-citizens who are on the list, and the numbers are still very, very small. There was just an article today about Tennessee, and the numbers were double digits in the entire state of Tennessee. Many of those people have turned out to be citizens. They were people who naturalized after they had last been at the BMV. And so trying to work through all of those various angles, and I am completely confident that the Ohio Attorney General did that to come to the conclusion that yes, there were five or six cases that were worthy of further pursuing, but the rest weren't.
So you talked about this sore loserism. Is there any way? I don't even know how to ask the question. Is there any way, as we look toward the 2026 and then 2028? I mean, things just feel more and more contentious as we move forward in life here. How do we tell people that it is okay, where no one's stealing an election?
Well, I think, you know, obviously we should tell them. I keep telling them it's what I do in my daily job every single day. Talking about the paper ballots, talking about the quality and accuracy of our voter lists better than ever before. But the single best way that anyone who has any doubts about our election system can find out how secure it is and really see it from the inside and see all the checks and balances that exist and the redundancies that exist is to volunteer to be a poll worker. Call your local election office, go online to your county election office and volunteer to be a poll worker. I've seen this time and again. People have had doubts, who have consumed lies on social media, who've lived in a bubble where they've been sincerely disappointed in the outcome of the election, and they've had grifters target them and that disappointment to try to get wealthy off of the disappointment from an election that didn't go their way. And this happens on both the right and the left. And the best thing anyone can do is to turn off that social media, get out of that bubble, and go serve your community. Go volunteer to be a poll worker. My teenage son has done it twice. I'm incredibly proud of him for doing that. Oftentimes in many jurisdictions, people who aren't eligible to vote yet, people who are maybe 16 or in high school, can also volunteer to be poll workers, as they can in my state. So I think that's the best way to do it. And whatever happens, we saw lies about a stolen election in 2024 related to Kamala Harris. We're still seeing those spread on the left. We're still suffering the incredible pain and abuse that's coming from those who have falsely claimed that the 2020 election was stolen. And if you hear after an election that your side lost, and you hear people try to tell you that your side didn't really lose, it was just a vast conspiracy of people to try to steal the election from you, you should know just first right away, that's a lie. The next thing they're going to ask for is money. And instead, call up your local county election office, volunteer to be a poll worker. You can go volunteer with your political parties or candidates to be an observer. You can watch every part of the process is transparent. So there's just no doubt about this, but our foreign adversaries in particular are highly incentivized to sow chaos in our democracy. I don't know if this news was reported yet, but in New Jersey, there were several polling places that had bomb threats. And if you recall, in that's today. In 2024, we had some bomb threats phoned into polling places around the country as well. And that was confirmed. That was our foreign adversaries. They're trying to sow chaos in our system. They're trying to get us to distrust our democracy, to distrust our fellow citizens who have volunteered and are serving to run our elections and give us all a voice. And it's incumbent upon all of us to push back on that, especially when our candidate loses, to accept defeat in a close election and to move on to the next campaign.
I want to say thank you for joining us today, David Becker, Executive Director and Founder of the Center for Election Innovation. Thank you for joining us, David.
Thank you, Amy.
And listeners out there, it's election day today. Vote. You have until 7:30 this evening. And don't just vote for Dancing with the Stars. Vote in the real election. Coming up, we're going to talk about a humanoid robot that helps out around the house. Is it a dream come true? That's when Tech Tuesday continues from all sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Tech Tuesday, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. When Bicentennial Man came out in 1999, we all laughed at the absurdity. 26 years later, meet Neo, a humanoid robot that helps out around the house. Here to tell us more is Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Welcome back to All Sides, Russell.
Thank you.
So the question we're all dying to ask for, are all sci-fi robots in movies that we watched in the past going to come to life now? Are robots taking over the world?
Certainly not this year. What we're seeing here with Neo is you know, certainly a step in that direction. There have been a couple of companies that have announced, you know, various forms of a humanoid robot that can help you around the house. None of them have actually reached, you know, kind of commercial viability. And what the company that is behind Neo, which is called 1X, is doing to kind of, you know, move around the challenge of a bipedal robot that wanders around your house and does all of your chores for you, is by having a human pilot it.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't really a standalone robot, but, you know, this isn't AI powered in the traditional sense. There isn't a great big computer brain in there that wanders around and does things. This is a $20,000 robot that has a 4-hour battery. And when it is in use, when it is wandering around your house, folding your laundry or, loading your dishwasher or something like that, it is a human somewhere else in the world that has a VR headset on and a set of custom controllers that it is using for hands, that it is, you know, going around and doing those things through the robot in your home.
So that doesn't sound like it's going to save me any time.
It will certainly save you time in that you could say, hey, please go, you know, take care of the dishes and it will wander off and do that. But do I have to wear specific situations?
Yeah. Do I have to wear the VR headset the whole time? Oh, okay.
This isn't you wearing the VR headset. You are never wearing the VR headset. Someone who is not in your home, someone who is in a computer center somewhere, or someone who is working remotely, someone you do not know, to be clear, but someone who works for this company, is going to have that headset on when the machine is up and running, for you to give instructions to.
Well, that's creepy.
Yes. The goal, according to the company.
Okay.
Yes. You are certainly not alone in this. This is a person you do not know who will be using cameras, you know, where the eye holes are on this robot to see what's going on in your home and to make those changes. You know, the deal here is that you are paying this company, and there is a trust agreement there that person, you know, who is doing these things in your house on your behalf would follow a very specific set of rules, and you know, any data in personal areas of your home would be purged. But the preview video, the announcement video for this certainly looked like an automated robot that is, you know, kind of moving around. And while the company certainly wants for a version of this robot in the future to be fully automated and be able mm-hmm. to, you know, kind of do things on its own in your home, as we have seen in, you know, science fiction movies for quite some time now, the reality of this particular robot is that it is another person, you know, somewhere else in the world that is controlling this thing that lives in your home.
Okay. So this is not Rosie from the Jetsons for me.
Correct. This is certainly a step in, you know, towards that direction. You know, but the actual promise of this machine is very much, you know, something that would happen much further in the future. It's unlikely that we would have something that is like Rosie really anytime in the next couple of years.
A couple of years. I expected you to say couple of decades. Okay, that's not life now. And then the $20,000 price tag. I mean, is that just a normal amount of money for a piece of tech like this? I don't even know how to equate it.
It is difficult to compare to. You know, so the, you know, the robotics hardware alone is certainly quite expensive. The research time that went into building something like this, you know, the price tag seems relatively reasonable, understanding, you know, we're talking about a thing that has more or less not existed, you know, within our lifetime at this point. But yeah, the payment plan here is twofold. You can either, you know, participate in early access with this, you know, remote controlled option, or you can spend a monthly $500 a month for what they consider the standard package, where you're not paying for the robot up front outside of a $200 deposit when you go to actually make the pre-order. And then, you know, this the same kind of robot in one of three different colors would show up at your home.
Are they in homes right now, or is this still in the development stages?
This is still very much in the development stage. There are a couple of folks this week who have gotten some hands-on time with these robots in very carefully controlled environments, you know, to kind of get an idea for the best version of this thing, as well as the, you know, sort of charging pod that it lives in when it's not being used. But yeah, this is, you know, this is certainly a unique step. This is a new thing, but it raises, I think, a lot of questions about whether you would actually want something like this in your home right this moment, even if you had the money for it.
I'm going to go with a no, but okay. This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about recent tech news with the Director of Commerce Content at CNET, Russell Hawley. I wanted to move on to talk about the FCC and the internet. For the past year and a half, internet providers have been required to display all broadband information, pricing, extra fees, and speeds. But this might change following a recent FCC vote. Can you tell us about what's been happening? Like, what, for the past year and a half, what is this information sharing?
Sure. So March of 2024, there was an FCC vote to essentially make it so that U.S. Internet providers had to, you know, create what was affectionately referred to as a nutrition label for their services. So, you know, the length of the contract, you know, how much the actual monthly price would be, any fees that would be tacked on top of that, all of that stuff had to be presented to the consumer before they clicked the buy button, which was a new thing at the time. And so for the last year and a half, if you go to buy from, you know, Comcast or AT&T or Verizon or any of these for home internet service, you had access to this broadband, you know, fax label that, you know, explained, you know, what was actually included in the contract that you were signing up for, you know, without having to go through pages and pages and pages of you know, legal stuff in order to click the buy button. The current FCC is now considering a vote that would, among other things, roll this back.
So who would want it rolled back? The companies don't want to share this. It just, it seems very like nice to disclose things. It's kind of like how your bill for your mortgage had to get more simple and like so you could understand it better, like look easier to read, basically. Is that do the companies not want that?
Yeah, it's not immediately clear how a move like this would benefit consumers, but this would absolutely make it so that internet service providers, could, bury details about fees and sign-up costs and things like that inside of the, initial contract, the way that, it had been done before. And not having to provide these nutrition labels certainly seems like it would benefit those companies immediately.
So do you think the companies are leaning on the FCC? They wanted this change?
There's, not any obvious evidence of that happening in the same way that you might see for other decisions that have been made, when it comes to consumer privacy and things like that. This is very much something that's it's difficult to find an upside for consumers here, but definitely some upsides for companies.
Yeah. Is this a done deal? Did the FCC approve the rollback?
No. So the vote that happened last week was what is called a notice of proposed rulemaking. This allows time for public comment before a final vote, though it's not immediately clear what the public comment period would be and what the result of that would be. But there will be a public comment period before a final vote from the FCC to make this decision. However, it seems fairly likely that this is something that would pass unless something fairly dramatic happened during that public comment period.
Oh, well, yeah, but it also sounds like something that's setting them up for a lawsuit in the future where you're taking away a consumer protection, basically.
It's certainly possible. I think that, there would also likely need to be some included language about, existing contracts that have been signed, with those very public terms, not being altered, so that folks who already have maybe a 2-year agreement with their cable company or something for broadband internet would be under those protections for at least, the remainder of that contract. But that is something that's going to have to come out as a part of that vote.
And moving on to our last topic that we have, Halloween just passed, and even Halloween decorations are becoming more technologically advanced. Can you tell me about the Sync smart lights?
Yeah, so there are, quite a few smart lights that are now, not just indoor, but outdoor as well. One of the more common ones are permanent outdoor lights that, they basically go every foot around your house. And allow you to install these lights under overhangs and things like that so that you can more or less paint your house in fun colors, no matter what time of year it is. It's not something that has to be one particular holiday specific, but, somebody who has a little bit of time and likes to decorate can have some fun with, the way that colors work on their house. GE, as a company, had released these Sync lights that accomplish this at quite a bit less than what a fair number of the competition have done. And in addition to that, they have these string lights that instead of being a bunch of individual lights, it's one very long strand that you can use a wire to organize in whatever shape you want. So you could imagine like a great big snowflake on the side of your house that was like all lit up and able to kind of, all change colors in any way that you might want, while it was set up in that pattern.
So is the days of getting up on a ladder in the freezing cold and trying to string lights from your roof, are they going to be going away?
I think that this is a reasonable alternative for folks who are not a fan of that. There are installation services that are not particularly expensive for light strips like these to be able to put them up on your house. And yeah, they're lights that you can have up all year long. You can choose, what each bulb does as far as, color output, or you can set them to patterns. So for things like holiday lights, it would be very easy to, to set up in a bunch of fun colors and have them run through, plus they're attached to the Sync app, which means they will turn on their own based on the schedule that you have provided. So at the very least, it's something that you just have to think about a lot less were you to invest in something like this.
And if one bulb goes out, do they all go out?
No, actually, these are all LED lights. So not only do they not go out like that, but they are relatively easy to replace.
Okay, so I'm guessing the bulbs last longer too. Everything, the technology's better, right?
Yeah, LED bulbs are expected to last quite a bit. They each, the entire strand has a 2-year warranty according to the Sync website. And You know, you get essentially 100 feet of these lights to you know, hang in a single line across your house for $143, which is quite a bit less than what you would get from a lot of the, you know, kind of competing outdoor lights of this nature.
Or hiring someone to put up the lights for you.
Or hiring someone to do it yourself. That is exactly right.
All right. Well, thank you for your time. Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Thanks for joining us today, Russell.
Thank you for having me.
And if you missed any part of today's show, you can listen back at WOSU.org/allsides. You can also always subscribe to the All Sides podcast. Every episode is also available for free in the WOSU Public Media mobile app. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook, and you can follow the show on Instagram. Our Instagram is at AllSidesWOSU. I want to say thanks to the All Sides staff, producers Marcus Charleston and Aaron Esmont-Rabinowitz, student producers Iza Huck, Colin Simpson, and Kira Burson, video production by the Ohio Channel, board operation by Chris Johnston and Cameron Howard. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.